stay back there, right? Okay. Thanks to the organizers for the invitation to talk. It's at a very nice conference you've got going here. And so what I'm going to tell you about is some ongoing work over the last, I guess, now year and a half or so with my student Nathaniel Johnson. And actually, I'll use this opportunity to give a plug for Nathaniel. He's finishing up his PhD this year, and he's really done a great job. And in fact, this subject that I'm going to talk about, really was Nathaniel that initiated this this work and sort of dragged me into it, pleasantly dragged me into it, but still really got things off the ground. And so I'm going to do first of all, sort of something non-standard. I'm going to give you I'll put the references up again at the end, but I wanted to put them up at the beginning here because they sort of tell the story on how we've been approaching this. I guess I should have put this note at the top. So really, what happened was and Nathaniel in particular was looking through the literature and noticed various investigations on subjects that will come up in my talk, in which what we realized eventually was that special cases of the norms that I'm going to tell you about were being used in various places throughout the literature, sprinkled through the literature, to tackle various problems, and they're sort of very localized and specialized problems. And so it wasn't so the first thing we did really was realize that these were all special cases of this general family of norms that I'm going to tell you about. And so what we did when we realized that, we acted like mathematicians, and we went and did a mathematical analysis of these norms, okay, and just treated them, just looked at them purely mathematically. And then we came back to some of these problems, and we've got some, I think, what are some nice applications so far to these problems I'm going to tell you about. So the papers sort of tell the story. So as I said, the first two papers here are essentially encompass what I just mentioned. And then actually, when we were sort of deep in this investigation, we found out that in fact this class of norms we're looking at actually is also very recently arisen in pure mathematics in operator theory for completely different reasons. And so this led to this work in which we've sort of formally made the connection between them. And so since I'm at Fields Institute, I'll try to tell you a little bit about that at the end of the talk. Okay, so where I'm going to go then, after giving you just the basic mathematical setting over a couple slides, what I'm going to do is before actually getting into the norms and then the applications, I'm going to, given I think it's kind of a mixed audience, I'm going to actually spend a little time telling you about one of the application areas, one of our main motivations, okay, and some of the mathematical connections between quantum information and some of the areas of mathematics. Okay, so that's in those slides. Then I'll tell you some basics of the norms, and then come back to the applications. Okay, so that's where I'm going. Okay, so to begin with, then, the basic notion that gets us off the ground is the Schmidt number. Okay, so if I have in my notation, HN is going to be n-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, and actually n and m are going to n is going to be equal to m pretty much after this slide. So if we have a state in a bipartite system, then the Schmidt decomposition theorem gives us a number k and orthogonal states ui vi, and then these non-negative scalars alpha I, such that v can be written in this form. Okay, decompose in this way, and it's called the Schmidt decomposition theorem. It really amounts to an observation essentially, which shows you that that vector state. It's one way to regard vector states as operators, and when you make that connection, the operators associated with a given state If you do the Schmidt decomposition, the singular value decomposition on the associated operator, it just drops out. That's where you get these scalars, for instance. Okay, so then the Schmidt number of a state is the smallest number, okay, k required in such a decomposition. Okay, and this is one way to get at this fundamental definition, right, of separable states and entangled states. States separable if its Schmidt number is one and otherwise entangled. Okay, so that's the basic notion that gets us off the ground. Now now when we go to general quantum states, okay, so now thinking of density operators, right, so I introduced notation here. I'll use L of H to be the set of linear operators on Hilbert space H. Then we have density operators, and we know we can always decompose them, spectral decomposition, or of course lots of ways. And it turns out that there's a little bit of work required to see this, but the natural notion of Schmidt number now extended to to general quantum states is now going to be the least number k, such that my rho can be written as such a sum. But now where I demand that each of the states in the sum have Schmidt number no more than k, okay, for all those states. And then from this perspective, rho is separable, again, generalizing the vector state case. Rho is separable if Schmidt number is equal to one, and otherwise entangled. Okay, and so here's one characterization of separability that's more intuitive. Okay, so Schmidt number. So I've got the Schmidt number for quantum states in hand now. Okay, so as I said, what I'm going to do now is tell you about one of our main application areas. Okay, and nothing about these norms until a little later. This first slide I'm going to put up verbatim later when I come back to the applications, okay? So K-block positive operators. All right, so what are they? So I'm going to fix K. Okay, so whenever you see a K now, think of it as a fixed integer between 1 and n, okay? Then a Hermitian operator X, okay, on that acts on the bipartite system. Is said to be K-block positive if this statement holds. Okay, so if the inner products x v v are non-negative for any v now with Schmidt rank, so Schmidt rank, Schmidt number. Okay, so that's you can flip back and forth there, but Schmidt number of v is bounded above by k. Okay, well the n-block positive operators. What are you looking at? Well. If you're looking at the n-block positive operators, every state has Schmidt number less than or equal to n. Okay, so you're not making any restriction there. Okay, so the n-block positive operators are exactly the positive operators. This is just the definition of what it means to be a positive operator. Okay, in when k is equal to n. Okay, now the connection with entanglement witnesses and just sort of I'm showing my bias coming from kind of the more my roots are kind of in the more operator theoretic or camp, so I'm coming at this from this notion of block positivity. That's the terminology that motivated this, but this idea of entangled witnesses is actually the same, okay, as block positivity in this sense. So these operators are also called K entanglement witnesses because it's a theorem that the Schmidt number of a quantum state rho is less than or equal to k if and only if these expectation values trace x rho greater than or equal to zero for all k block positive operators x. Okay, so they can these block positive operators can be used to detect entanglement in this sense. Okay, and so the motivation comes from the k equal to one case, the terminology. There. Okay. So, again, I'm gonna later when I come back to applying these norms, I'm gonna have this exact same slide up. But let me make the connection. So again, sort of in deference to being at the Fields Institute, let me make a connection with really a large area of mathematics. Okay, area of mathematical study. So the next two slides are in a sense a little mini tutorial on this connection. my flesh-colored microphone here. Okay, so I'm going to now look at linear maps. All right, so I have a linear map, phi, on n-dimensional space. If you like, I mean, the nicest case of one of these is going to be a completely positive map with the nice Krauss operator representation and everything. Okay, but I'm not limiting myself to completely positive maps, and that's the point, really. Looking at an arbitrary linear map. Now, if I'm given k, then the definition of what it means to be a k-positive linear map, okay, is this statement. In other words, I take my map and I put it together with the kth identity map, okay, the kth identity map, and I mean the identity map that acts on k-dimensional, the k-dimensional operator space, okay. And so I then have a map, right, that acts on k tensor n-dimensional operator space. It's going to be a linear map, and then phi is said to be k-positive, okay, if this map itself is positive. In other words, if this map is k-positive, if when you take a positive operator in here, hit it with this map, I get a positive operator back again, okay? So that's what k-positive means. Now, when k is equal to n, this is actually the familiar completely positive, the definition of a completely positive map. Well, okay, so there are a number of equivalent definitions of completely positive maps that you can show through various results that they are equivalent. But when k is equal to 1, and this is one way to define what a completely positive map is in this particular case. And so these are now very familiar in quantum information, and there's this wonderful structure theory that we can play with completely positive maps, developed by primarily Choi in the early 70s and a number of others. So there's a very rich theory here and a lot of nice things you can do. So one of the basic mathematical questions was, what's going on in between? Because so that's k equal to n. When k is equal to 1, right, when k is equal to 1, that's not there. You're just looking at positive maps, right, positive maps, positive linear maps. And there is no such structure theory available for positive maps. And in fact, it's a dog's breakfast, what I would call a dog's breakfast, okay? It's a complete mess. There are some basic things you can say, but there's really no hope of getting any sort of general structure theory. So a basic question in mathematics and operator theory for now in the neighborhood of 40 years is, you know, what can you say in between, right? At the two extremes, we have, and these are just integers here, right, we're looking at, as k is equal to n, we have this wonderful structure theory, k equal to 1, we have madness. So where do things go awry, right? And what can you say in between? And the answer is not much. Okay. And so that's one of the basic mathematical motivations for looking at these k block positive operators and maps. And right. And so the connection with entanglement witnesses and block positivity comes in this way. So if I take the maximally entangled state on a bipartite system, and then define this operator where now I look at the identity, the nth identity map tensor with my map phi acting on the pure state determined by the maximally entangled state. So what do I get? I get an operator. So phi determines an operator, right? Phi is a linear map on here. Okay, phi is a linear map on here. And when I define this, what I'm getting is an operator that lives on here, okay? So it's an operator on n tensor n dimensional space. Well, this is the Choi-Yamakowski isomorphism, okay, that is pretty familiar now in quantum information. In other words, it's an isomorphism between, it allows you to identify linear maps like this and operators like this, okay? And there are a number of features in the Choi-Yamakowski isomorphism that you can say things about phi, certain things about phi that correspond to certain things about x, and vice versa. Okay, so it's a very useful connection. Now how does it connect? Well, the point is this isomorphism connects the two notions I just spoke of. Okay, in this way, so it's a basic result that you sort of have to piece together in the literature actually, but that phi is a k-positive map, that notion I just introduced on the last slide, if and only if the operator that map determines, okay, X5, is a K-block positive operator, okay, in other words, a K-entanglement witness, okay? So saying things about K-positive maps, it means you're saying things about K-block positive operators or entanglement witnesses and vice versa, okay? So you can go back and forth between either perspective with this, using this isomorphism. Okay, so that's one of the main application areas that we get with these norms that I'm about to tell you about, and it's an area that's you know, for the last, it's been of interest in quantum information for the last, say, 15 years now, and of interest in operator theory for about 40 years. Interestingly, with very different motivations, right? Which is usually the case, and which is actually one of the things that makes it kind of interesting. Okay, so here's the here are the norms. Okay. Now the most important norms we look at are operator norms, but they're motivated by vector norms. Okay, so I'm gonna briefly go through the vector norms, and they'll give motivation for the operator norms. So I'm gonna start with a state on bipartite system, and then fix RK as usual. Okay, then you can define this vector K norm that we call with a little sk subscript in this way. You take the sup over all states W, absolute value of inner products, W with V, but now where you restrict yourself to states with Schmidt number at most K, all right? Yeah. W, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I guess, yeah, that's, yeah, I didn't say that, but yeah, I mean, when I'm using the cat notation, I mean, yeah. So unit vector, yeah, thank you. So unit vector is W. Unit vector is W. And actually, yeah, I'm defining this, I guess, for unit vectors, but it naturally extends. It's a norm. It extends to any vector. When k is equal to n, well, I mean, you're not making any restriction on the states you're looking at. You're taking a sup over the entire unit ball. So this is just another way of looking at the standard Euclidean norm, okay, the standard 2 norm for a vector, okay? But in general, you are restricting the set of vectors you're souping over, right? So you're going to get this decreasing, or at least a non-increasing sequence of norms, right? A whole family of norms you get here. Well, what is this? Well, in the case of vector norms, it's easy to compute them. Okay, so now remember the Schmidt coefficients for a state. Let's assume without loss of generality they're ordered, like so. Then the k vector norms are simple to compute. In fact, what it is, it's just the L2 norm, the 2 norm, the Euclidean norm of the first k, the k biggest Schmidt coefficients. Okay, so they're easy to compute, and so as you might expect, I mean, something that easy to compute can't be very useful, and they're not. But they motivate the operator norms, which are quite useful and also quite difficult to get a handle on. Okay, as you see, as I'll try to show you a little bit. All right, so now these are operator norms, and they're defined on, so if I'm going to take an operator that acts on the bipartite system, n tensor n, okay, fix k again, then you're going to define these what we call the operator k norm. Now we're looking at the subscript capital S k, and I'm going to soup now over, yes, unit vectors v and w, and these absolute values, where again I'm going to restrict my Schmidt number, my states to have Schmidt number at most k, all right? Well, k equal to n, again, no restriction. And what do you get? Well, this is just another way of writing the standard operator norm, okay? And by the operator norm, I mean, you know, for a matrix, the operator norm of a diagonal matrix is the maximal in absolute value, the maximal eigenvalue, okay? The maximal diagonal entry, for instance, right? So that's just the basic operator norm. In general, though, you do make restrictions. And so, you get this decreasing, this non-increasing family of norms. Okay, so what's the point? Well, I'm not going to state the theorem, but you can show that computing these operator norms, the k, so for a general kth operator norm, even just for positive operators, is actually equivalent to the problem of determining k-block positivity of an operator. Okay. Yep. So you mean different? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We could talk later, but maybe. But yeah, that's interesting thought. Yeah. So we haven't looked at that is the quick answer, but we could talk later. Yeah. So, okay. So computing these things is actually equivalent to this. Hopefully, you can take my word for it. It's a deep problem, and it really is a deep problem to determine k-block positivity of an arbitrary operator. And there's a theorem that makes that explicit. A theorem of ours that makes that explicit. And so, as I said, determining k-block positivity extensively studied by mathematicians for about 40 years, but no complete method is known. And in fact, it's hodgepodge. There's not much available what you can do. So computing these norms is quite difficult. But what you can do is derive a number of inequalities and use the inequalities to get a number of tests, including as far as we can tell, the most general test that's available. Yeah?
Is determining k-block positivity approximately as hard as determining separability, or?
I think that might be a special case, actually.
Because
separability.
One block positivity.
Yeah, yeah. 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 I'll tell you about some special cases. And so as far as we can tell, this is what we were able to do is develop the most general test, and I'll at least state the result for you. I'm segueing now into the applications. And again, this is that slide on k-block positivity that I already put up, but I put it up again for the record. So there's k-block positivity. That's what you want to do. And so here's a sort of a summary on what's been done. It's not a complete summary, of course. It's just one page. But so there are a number of tests, many spectral tests, in fact, for determining whether or not an operator is k-block positive in special situations. So they're kind of scattered. What we were able to do, so the way I think of what we I'm going to show you on the next slide is we've proved this sort of abstract, this I think of it as a the theorem as a giving a general kind of abstract machine for testing k-block positivity. And it doesn't look like it looks too abstract when you first see it, I think, but a number of concrete tests for k-block positivity can be derived from it. And in fact, numerous tests that have previously appeared in the literature drop out of it, plus we get some new ones. Okay, so that's what I'm going to, in just a couple minutes, tell you about. This is the abstract theorem, just to give you an idea of what it looks like. So you're going to start, remember, we're going to start with an operator, Hermitian operator on n tensor n, dimensional space, operator space, and it's Hermitian, I have it spectral, it's spectral decomposition. The relevant projections are going to be the projection onto the negative eigenvalue eigenspace, spaces, okay, so you add up the negative eigenvalue eigenspaces, and that's px negative, and then px not is the null space projection for the operator. Then, so you don't get a complete if and only if statement here. You get three cases that are kind of messy at first glance. They give tests embedded in them for k-block positivity. Turns out, though, you can get a number of concrete corollaries. And so here's a collection of them. So first of all, number of negative eigenvalues. If it's k-block positive, then it has at most n minus k squared negative eigenvalues, you can get if you look at the maximal and minimal eigenvalues, you can get this ratio bounded below by 1 minus n over k. When the operator is k-block positive, it has to satisfy that. Then there's another just blowing through some results. There's another result that interpolates between the two in a sense, and I think that one of the nicer results we've got so far is that these kth operator norms actually give a full, if and only a full, necessary and sufficient condition to determine when an operator is k-block positive if it has two distinct eigen, if it has a pair of distinct eigenvalues, okay? So when x is, sorry, it's, I'd make that a dagger, when x is Hermitian and it has two distinct eigenvalues, and if we look at the negative eigenspace projection, okay, then x is k-block positive if and only if this inequality is satisfied, okay? Where, so that's the kth operator norm of the projection P minus, okay? So two distinct eigenvalues, that's obviously a small number, but still, like I said, this is a very difficult problem, and I'm certainly become convinced of that. So, okay, so that is k-block positivity and our applications there. What so a couple of the different directions we've gone in a little bit, the other directions are that that result on the previous slide can be used to tackle really one of the, again, as far as I can tell, one of the deepest problems in quantum information theory, the determining the existence of non-positive partial NPPT bound entangled states. Now, we haven't done anything, I would say, significant, really significant there. What we have done is used this approach to frame that problem, which is another dog's breakfast, actually, to try to get a handle on it. But we've been able to frame it in terms of a basic and an easy to state calculus problem that, at least in principle, could be, you know, an undergraduate student could actually look at it and play around with it a little bit. And which maybe I have it on a slide. I'll just kind of blow through. But like as I said, since I'm at Fields Institute, maybe I should I'll spend my last few minutes just going over a few slides that make this connection with this this recent work in operator spaces, in the theory of operator spaces, which really surprised us. Okay, but on the NPPT bound entangled states, okay, you can close your eyes if you want. Ignore. Obviously, I had too many slides, so. But if I go to, all right, so just to give you, so as I said, the calculus problem. A certain state is bound entangled if and only if this limit. So that's what I meant by a calculus problem. If and only if this limit equals 1/2. Okay. So it's something with basic, you know, with say a second course in linear algebra. You could, and a course in calculus. You could at least in principle play around with this thing. I'm not saying it makes it any easier. It's likely sweeping all sorts of stuff under the rug. But anyway, there is a concrete problem there to work on. Okay. But what's the connection with operator spaces? So again, this is a very rich field of mathematics in its own right, so I'm not going to do it justice. I'm just going to give you a real raw sort of brief introduction to it. It's actually an area of mathematics that's sort of, I think of it, it's operator spaces is kind of a subset of operator theory, and it's an area where there are increasingly people are recognizing connections between operator spaces and quantum information, and there have been a couple Banff workshops that have focused on this, actually, and people are developing these connections further. Okay, but just very, very briefly, an operator space, you can think of it as a subspace. So as the name suggests, it's a subspace of operators. Okay, so it's a subspace of operators. There is, I'm saying concrete in brackets because there is an abstract notion. You can axiomatize the whole business, all right? But let's just take, it's going to be a subspace of operators, and then so an operator system is going to be dagger closed subspace. But the point with an operator space, especially when you get into the axiomatization, it's not just the subspace itself you look at. You consider it together with all of them, with the, so I could write that as the tensor. So I think of these as the m by m matrices with entries in V. Okay, so I can think of the extended operator space extended to larger spaces. Okay, and together with the corresponding norms that are brought with it. Okay. All right, so you can put, now, given just a basic vector space or a subspace of operators, you can put different norms on it, just like you can with a vector space, right? With a vector space, you can define different norms, different ways to measure distances and lengths in even in R2, right? Things like that. You can do the same thing with these operator spaces, and that goes back quite a while now, about 30 years, and it turns out that amongst all the different structures you can put on these things, There's a min and a max one, okay, and I'm not going to tell you about them other than to say it is what you think it would be, basically, okay. So basically, the norms you put on that define the minimum structure and the norms that define the maximum structure satisfy this sort of inequality for any norm. So any norm is going to be between any other norm is going to be between the two. Okay. Okay. Now, how does it connect with this K, the K operator norms, and K block positivity and all that stuff? Well, very recently, and this is what was interesting to us, very recently, in, at least in pure math terms, right? This is still very recent. There was some work, and this is the main publication, but there have been some other papers in pure math that have looked at this. But there is this for k between one and n, looks familiar, right? There have been defined these k max and k min structures, okay? And they were used basically to do completely different motivations than what we are trying to do. And there are a number of results in that third paper I mentioned. There are a number of results that make an explicit connection between the stuff we're doing and others in quantum information and this work in operator theory. And here's one of the basic results, just to give you an idea. The basic point is that these kth operator norms really are the same as these k-min norms, in a sense, when you look at things in the right way. Okay, so there really is kind of this formal bridge between these two areas now, I think, that's been created, and we're a number of people, I guess, are still trying to kind of get a handle on what this means, and if anything, right? But anyway, I think that's of interest. So sort of running out of time, so I'll finish back to those references. So thanks for your time.